Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find it on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes.
As America slowly says goodbye to Iraq, the challenge inside the country is immense.
Iraq's future is in the hands of its own people, and Iraq's leaders must now make some hard choices necessary to resolve key political questions, to advance opportunity, and to provide security for their towns and their cities. In this effort, America will be a strong partner to the Iraqi people on behalf of their security and prosperity.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki meets with President Obama at the White House today. How will his trip be seen inside Iraq itself? Coming up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, July 22nd. I'm Lynn Scherr, along with Farai Chidea. We're sitting in today for John Hockenberry. Morning, Farai.
Hey, Lynn.
On The Takeaway this hour, President Obama takes his pitch for changing health care straight to you, just as the battle in Washington heats up. We'll get views from around the country, including yours, ahead of the president's primetime news conference. Plus, ice cream for breakfast? Mario Batali's pastry chef shows us how Sicilians start a hot summer day. But let's begin in Iraq. Alyssa Rubin is just ending her term as Baghdad bureau chief for the New York Times. Alyssa, what's first on the agenda as the Iraqi leader visits President Obama today?
Well, as you know, the surge was supposed to kind of create the space to achieve political reconciliation. And that's something that's still a bit of a mirage on the horizon. There's still a lot of distrust between Sunnis and Shias and also between Arabs and Kurds. And particularly heated, not even a debate, really tension all along the border between Iraqi Kurdistan and the rest of the country, where there's a lot of oil and a lot of discomfort on the Kurdish side with what they see as the central government's increasing power and Mr. Maliki's increasing power.
Alyssa, thank you. More of our conversation with you in a moment. But first, everything you need to know this morning, Farai.
Well, in the headlines, President Obama meets the press to push his health care agenda. In a primetime news conference, reporters are also going to ask about other topics. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has strong words on Iran's nuclear ambitions. She warns that if Iran gets the bomb, the U.S. will ramp up defense capacity of American allies in the Mideast. Clinton is in Thailand today. She's meeting with Asian leaders at a regional summit. She's also giving a new warning to North Korea about its nuclear program.
Elsewhere in Asia, U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke is in Pakistan meeting with top leaders. He is also visiting Afghanistan on this trip. Our partner, The New York Times, reports Pakistani officials tell the Obama administration they're worried that the new American push in Afghanistan will drive more militants into Pakistan. There's not a single F-22 jet flying in Afghanistan or in Iraq, for that matter. That's why senators are killing the pricey fighter program. They're stripping money for more F-22s out of the Pentagon's budget. Defense Department, President Obama, and Senator John McCain all say the planes don't help in today's unconventional wars. Supporters say the program creates good jobs and the planes would be needed in a future war.
All right. So President Obama is holding this primetime news conference tonight. Taking questions, what would you ask? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
4 years ago, when he became Iraq's prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki worried that Iraqis had lost all hope to lead a normal life there. That was also the time of his first visit to Washington. Today, he returns to the White House to meet with President Obama, a visit designed to show that the U.S. is normalizing its relations with Iraq. Al-Maliki's trip comes amid increasing violence in Iraq. Yesterday, bombs killed 19 people and wounded 80 across Iraq in a flurry of attacks, just 3 weeks after the U.S. military completed its withdrawal from the cities. This visit also comes amidst the entire U.S. troop drawdown. The two leaders have plenty to talk about: Iraq security, U.S. withdrawal, continuing ethnic tension, and, of course, oil. Joining us for all of this is the BBC's Jim Muir from Iraq. He is in Kurdistan in the north of the country. And Alyssa Rubin, the former Baghdad bureau chief for The New York Times, she joins us from Paris. Good morning again, Alyssa. Let's start with you. What do you think will be very first on the agenda today?
Well, I think there are three or four things, and several of them fall under the same rubric of reconciliation. And that involves, of course, the Kurds, but it also involves Iraq's Sunni minority. And there's a lot of worry about the extent to which and the speed at which Mr. Maliki has integrated Sunnis into the government. And that is a big concern for the U.S., particularly as they withdraw and are less present on the ground in mixed neighborhoods.
Is it possible, Alyssa Rubin, for these ethnic tensions to get smoothed out? This is something that's been going on for so many years, centuries in that country. Can it really happen now?
I think there are a variety of different issues. The Kurdish problem is an ethnic one. Then there are sectarian Sunni-Shia issues. I think both have a really huge economic component. If everybody were doing well and were sort of financially affluent or at least comfortable and felt they had possibilities, I think you'd see a lot less. The difficulty is that, at least along, as I'm sure Jim will explain, along the Iraq-Kurdistan border, the borders of with the three provinces that are predominantly Kurd, that there is a lot of oil, and there's a real debate about how and who controls the drilling for that oil.
Not only who controls the drilling, but who gets the profits from it. Jim Muir from the BBC, you are indeed there. What are the prospects for an agreement about oil profits in that part of the country?
Well, at the moment, it's really just put on the back burner. Up here, the main preoccupation is elections, because on Saturday, the Kurds are going to the polls, and there is a real buzz of excitement up here, I have to say. It's not dissimilar to the Obama phenomenon back where you are in the States, but also next door in Iran, the Mir Hossein Mousavi phenomenon during the recent elections there. Young people have really latched on to this reformist leader called Nosheerwan Mustafa, who's the number two, who was the number two in Mr. Talabani's big party up here. That's the Iraqi president, who's also Kurdish, but has split off and formed a kind of reform movement called Change. And they are pushing very hard. They're riding a wave of support from young people in particular, but from a lot of people who are really fed up with the two big parties who've been dominating politics up here for the past two decades. So that's very much the focus up here. They're expected to do well. They probably won't win, but they'll get a sizable majority. But there really is a feeling of change in the air, and that is the name they've given to their party. That is what's dominating thoughts up here at the moment, and ideas about how to resolve the disputes over oil will be left to the months that follow.
How closely are Iraqis actually watching this on Iraqi television, in the newspapers? You're saying there's a lot of buzz where you are. Is that true all over the country?
Just in Kurdistan, because that's where the elections are taking place. It's the three provinces, Dohuk, Erbil, and Sulaymaniyah, which make up officially the autonomous region of Iraqi Kurdistan. And they're voting for their own parliament, which they've had for many years actually now, but also for the president. It's the first time that the Kurdish president has been subject to a direct mandate from the people. As I say, there is this extraordinary feeling that Nosheerwan, the reformist leader, has unleashed a kind of forces, the same kind of reformist forces or aspirations for change that we saw both in the States and in Iran next door. Now, of course, in Iran they were stifled. Here the political culture is different. The two big parties do dominate, but they are at least in theory committed to democracy, freedom, and all that sort of stuff. So they can't simply stifle this really impressive movement that is now taking place up here.
Alyssa Rubin of the New York Times. This is Farai. Just wanted to get your reaction to a little bit from the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Chris Hill. He was speaking on C-SPAN.
This is the year where, in addition to getting our forces out of the remaining cities, as we've just done, we're also going to be reducing the overall number of forces. We have some 120,000, 130,000 forces in Iraq today, and the plan is, and we're going to follow this plan, is that by August of next year, that is just 13 months from now, we'll be down to between 35,000 and 50,000 forces, and they will be entirely in a training role.
Now, he just said this yesterday. Given the violence, is that realistic?
Well, I think it all depends if the violence accelerates or not. Iraq has shown it can tolerate pretty high levels of violence before the wheels really come off. And these episodes one big suicide bombing. These were lots of little episodes, and that's something people have gotten pretty used to over the last 5-6 years. And so I think if you see sort of low-level violence, primarily in Baghdad and large parts of the country, relatively quiet, then yes, it is possible. I mean, after all, Iraqis now have to ask us to come into the cities to help. Until they do that, and I think they will be very reluctant to do that because they don't want to suggest that they're dependent on the United States. Mr. Maliki doesn't want to suggest that, and neither do other politicians. We really don't have anything to do other than to leave, except for those people who are staying as trainers.
Let me go back to Jim Muir with the BBC. A Wall Street Journal yesterday published an interview with Mr. al-Maliki in which he actually, not surprisingly, disagreed with critics who say he's got too much power. How is he viewed in that country? Is he viewed as someone with too much power, or can he pull this off, and will he get reelected?
I think it depends who, because Iraqis are quite divided in their perceptions of things. It depends which Iraqis you're talking about. Among many Arab Iraqis, there is certainly a feeling that he is doing the right thing, because there is a great thirst for authority, for the state, for things above militias and narrow sectarian interests. And he played that card very cleverly in provincial elections back in January, when instead of his own party is called the Dawa Party, it's an Islamist Shiite party, but then they changed their name for the elections. They called themselves the State of Law. And those are the two concepts that Iraqis yearn for, the state and law, the rule of law and order. So for a lot of Arab Iraqis, the emergence of something like a strong man in Baghdad with consensus of the people is something fairly welcome. But up here in Kurdistan, it's a different business. They do see a kind of autocratic side. They fear the development of a kind of centralist mentality in Baghdad, which, of course, they paid a very high price for in the past, the Kurds. They were heavily persecuted by Saddam Hussein and lost many tens of thousands of people killed by his regime. So there is anxiety up here. I talked to Masoud Barzani, for example, the president of Iraqi Kurdistan. He quite diplomatically suggested that he was worried about signs of autocracy and over-centralism taking root in Baghdad once again.
Just quickly, Jim Muir, is the United States doing enough? Will they have to do more, or can this all work out?
Well, again, talking to people like Mr. Barzani, there is a lot to be done. There's this fault line, an ethnic fault line that runs from the Syrian border over in the west down to the Iranian border to the east. And basically, they are very worried that when the Americans are no longer there to police, as it were, or to referee that line, which has had a lot of tension along it, especially in Kirkuk and Mosul and other areas that lie along that line, disputed territories, oil rich as well. It's a very explosive and combustible situation. They do want the Americans to work very hard before they pull out to make sure that differences are resolved. And there's a lot of thorny issues over Kirkuk and so on, which the Kurds claim they want it as part of Kurdistan. A lot of thorny issues there, and a lot of work needs to be done to make sure that it doesn't all burst into flames when the Americans do pull out.
All right. Jim Muir, BBC reporter in Iraq from Kurdistan, thanks so much for joining us. And Alyssa Rubin, former Baghdad bureau chief for The New York Times, thanks to you as well.
Well, Lynn, also on our minds this morning is health care. President Obama holds a primetime press conference tonight to sell his plan. Any question, though, is on the table. If you were a reporter, or if you are a reporter, what would you ask the president tonight? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you can get updates from our man in D.C., Todd Zwillick. He's tweeting the healthcare debate. You can follow him at thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scher in for John. Today is Wednesday, which means we talk about all things edible on The Takeaway, including some surprising food choices. Who knew that breakfast could be one way to beat the heat? We're not talking about chugging a frappuccino. We're talking about breakfast the Sicilian way, ice cream. Gina DePalma is the pastry chef at Mario Batali's restaurant Babbo in New York City. She's also the author of Dolce Italiano, Desserts from the Babbo Kitchen, and blogs on SiriusEats.com. And you arrived bearing gifts. We love you for that.
I sure did.
Okay. So,
not that hot this morning, but...
Yeah, but we've got one. I'll describe what we've got in front of us. What looks like a hamburger bun with a whole bunch of...
Ice cream. Gelato.
Okay.
That's what that
is. And it's not a hamburger bun.
It is. Well, it is. It's a brioche bun. It's an Italian version of brioche, which is a very, like, soft kind of eggy bread. And they stuff it with gelato. And the other thing that you have over there is called granita al café con panna, which is just coffee granita with cream.
And it's beautiful. It's this parfait with... I guess what's the coffee
at
the bottom?
It's granita, which is basically just coffee that's been frozen and kind of made slushy.
It also smells good. It all smells good, don't you think?
Yeah, it's all
good
stuff.
I'm going to taste it, too.
I'm looking on this, as you described it, hamburger bun with ice cream, which, as we now know, is a brioche with gelato. I'm looking at it as yogurt and whole wheat bread.
Well, you could look at it that way. What this really is just an embellished version of the standard Italian breakfast. Italians usually start out breakfast with a roll, a brioche, or a cornetti, which is kind of an Italian version of a croissant, and a cappuccino. And they're very small in comparison to American servings. And that's kind of what starts their day. But in Sicily, where it's not uncommon to wake up at 8 a.m. to 80 degrees, mm-hmm. and that's your low temperature for the day. I think it's kind of ingenious. You know, if it's going to be that miserably hot, you might as well have ice cream for breakfast. So they take that kind of standard roll and they stuff it with ice cream and have that.
It's quite delicious. Mm-hmm. And
you must be psychic too, Gina, because it's my favorite flavor. It's pistachio.
Pistachio, yep.
So remind me what the difference is between gelato and actual ice cream?
Well, gelato is, of course, Italian version of ice cream. I think it's definitely milkier and less egg embellished.
I'm getting at the obvious. There is actual nourishment here.
Yes,
this is not
absolutely
bad for you.
Protein. Definitely, they would say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And another thing, Italians believe in having like milk or cream with coffee only in the morning. They don't tend to have cappuccino in the afternoon. So this is kind of a really ultra rich way to get your morning coffee. Also to have the coffee granita with whipped cream.
And it's also better, I'm about to say, better than butter. It's better than having a roll with butter on it. Somehow the ice cream adds a, what do you think, Farai, a certain je ne sais quoi?
Yes, but how do you say je ne sais quoi in Italian?
Non lo so.
Okay.
Yeah,
there you go.
Exactly. There you go.
Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about your craft. You are the pastry chef at Mario Batali's restaurant Babbo, and it is, you know, the whole brand that Mario Batali has created is sort of this super chef brand, and I'm assuming that you're a super pastry chef. How'd you even get into this?
Well, into pastry in general, I've been doing this for 15 years, actually, and I worked at a lot of great places, and was lucky too. And Mario called me when he was going to open up Babbo and say, hey, we're going to do this great thing, and you're Italian, and I hear you really know your stuff when it comes to Italian things, and, you know, you want to come be my pastry chef. And that was in 1998, so it's been kind of, you know, a nice wild decade. We just celebrated our 11th anniversary, so.
And doing incredibly well. Now, do you serve things like this at the restaurant? Because you're not really open
well,
for breakfast.
Yeah, we're not open for breakfast. It's kind of hard to find something like this here in New York. We tried at our other restaurant, Otto, to have brioche and ice cream and gelato for breakfast. But it didn't really, I don't think it's something that we can really wrap our heads around. But you mentioned something that's very interesting, which is frappuccinos. So anybody who might say, oh, my God, ice cream for breakfast, that's ridiculous. But when you walk out of a Starbucks with a 20-ounce, you know, venti frappuccino, you're pretty much
thing.
Having the same thing.
I don't know why you think anybody would say, although I did in the opening to the program, ice cream for breakfast, because this is a country where we actually eat cold pizza for breakfast,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
exactly. Well, you know, everybody,
yeah,
everybody
I don't think
has
I would eat ice cream for breakfast. I mean, this is delicious, but
it is a new way of thinking about
it.
And I must say that I think the genius of so many chefs like you, obviously, is they make us think about things we hadn't thought about before. Mm-hmm. It sort of wakes up your brain a little bit. Oh, yeah, I could do that. You don't have to have the standard thing all the
time. Exactly. And that's what food and food culture does. It kind of makes us all look at things differently because Italians don't have that savory breakfast culture that we have. They don't have eggs and bacon and
or Japanese
things like that.
Japanese
exactly.
folks who have fish,
yeah,
right? Chinese
exactly.
folks who have the rice porridge that's not sweet, you know.
Absolutely.
Everyone's different.
Italians have sweet breakfast. They have a sweet roll and a sweet cup of coffee.
Well, you're sweet to bring this to us. And again, Gina De Palma is the pastry chef at Mario Batali's restaurant Babbo in New York City, also the author of Dolce Italiano, Desserts from the Babbo Kitchen. She blogs on SiriusEats.com, and thank you.
I can make your heart beat short. I can make you ice cream. We could be a sweet tea melting in your ice cream sport.
Ooh, Femi, okay, now you have headlines.
I certainly do. 28 minutes past the hour. Buongiorno, everybody. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has a warning for Iran. She says that if it continues to develop nuclear weapons, the U.S. will expand its protection to allies in the Middle East.
If the United States extends a defense umbrella over the region, if we do even more to support the military capacity of those in the Gulf, it's unlikely that Iran will be any stronger or safer.
Secretary Clinton spoke in Thailand, where she's meeting with Asian leaders at a regional summit. In Washington, President Obama is praising the Senate's decision to end future production of the Air Force's F-22 fighter jets.
At a time when we're fighting two wars and facing a serious deficit, this would have been an inexcusable waste of money.
The move also received praise from Republicans, including the president's former rival, Arizona Senator John McCain.
This is not the way to provide jobs. Our obligation is to defend this nation.
The F-22 has not been used in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke is heading back to Capitol Hill for a second day before Congress. Yesterday, he tried to assure lawmakers that the Fed can handle the giant stimulus and prevent a flare-up of inflation once the economy is back on its feet. Let's look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you so much, Femi. And give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. What would you ask the president tonight, if you could?
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at Skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
President Barack Obama holds a live primetime press conference tonight, mostly to sell his health care plan. It's already been a tough summer for the president. Two wars, casualty numbers disturbingly high in Afghanistan, the economy, well, the economy, climbing unemployment, and his own poll numbers predictably down. He is likely to take some heat tonight from the press on just those issues and more. Our friend Julie Mason will be there. Julie is the White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner, and she joins us this morning from D.C. Julie, welcome.
Good morning.
We know that health care is the top priority tonight. We'll get there in a little bit. But what else is on the agenda? What do you expect to come up at this press conference?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the press corps is pushing back pretty hard on a lot of issues, and they want to get Obama off health care a little bit, and he just wants to focus on health care. So I think we're going to see reporters asking him on a lot of different subjects. You mentioned a few. His drop in the polls has been in the news this week. Trouble with his own party on health care and the economy. Also, Georgia wants some new weapons systems, and you mentioned Afghanistan looks bad. The president is meeting earlier today with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki of Iraq. So that might come up as well. So there's a lot of different things that they're going to be pressing him on.
There's something else that he might want to talk about, budget cuts we heard about yesterday. Let's take a listen to what the president said.
I reject the notion that we have to waste billions of taxpayer dollars on outdated and unnecessary defense projects to keep this nation secure.
Julie, what about that? You think there'll be questions on that?
No, I really don't. I think that's sort of a resolved issue in most people's minds. And it doesn't have that particular issue doesn't have real political overtones. So you don't really hear about it as much around the White House. It's more of a congressional / Pentagon issue.
You're suggesting that the way the reporters are going into the press conference is only to deal with the political issues?
Well, they prefer the political issues.
Yeah,
they prefer something that has
a little heat.
A little heat, exactly. We thrive on conflict, and we thrive on where things go wrong, not where things go well.
Let's talk about health care just for a minute. We're going to be talking about it a lot further in this program. But in terms of the president, what is the best he can hope for in getting his health care message out there? Reporters are not there to push his agenda.
Exactly. And again, here we're at cross purposes with the president in these press conferences. He doesn't want to make a lot of news. He just wants to keep the issue in the news. You know, he's trying to generate more public support for his health care reform. But we've seen in the polls this past week that fewer than 50% of Americans now support him on health care. So he has a real problem. So he's trying to make the sale. He's trying to just really push it and make it more appealing to Americans and strike just the right tone. We've seen him go back and forth this week, trying to be more aggressive and then trying to be more sort of sounding very cooperative. And so he's looking for his footing on the issue.
And I know that going into these press conferences is a bit of a performance on the part of some reporters, certainly not you. I know you've done your homework. But can you give us a preview? What do you want to ask the president if, in fact, you're called on?
Well, I am interested in why he thinks his poll numbers have slipped so precipitously. I mean, everybody knew his numbers were going to come down. They were artificially high going in. Everybody loved him. And now they're really, he's really dropped far below where he should be just not even 6 months into the administration or just 6 months into the administration. So I would like to hear his take on what's behind those numbers and what he's going to do about it.
Okay, Julie, I do hope you get called on, and we will be watching. Our friend Julie Mason. Julie Mason, White House correspondent for the Washington Examiner.
All right, Lynn, we're asking folks, what would you ask the president if given the chance tonight? Not just reporters, but everyone. To help us answer that question, we have Dr. Peter Ubel, who's a physician and behavioral scientist in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Kristen Rouse, welcome back to the show, first lieutenant in the Army National Guard and a veteran of the war in Afghanistan. And Akeen McKenzie, visual display artist. We have Christian and Akeen in the studio, and we're going to talk with you guys later on the show about Obama's focus on health care. But we want to, hear what else was on your mind. Kristen Rouse, let's start with you. What would you ask?
I recognize that there's hugely important issues here at home, but we have major combat operations underway in Afghanistan, we have troops in harm's way in Iraq, and we have an American soldier being held hostage right now in Afghanistan. I think about that every day. And so what I want to know is what concrete assurances can this administration give the troops serving overseas right now and the troops who are waiting to go overseas? What concrete assurances can the administration give that our nation has the long-term resolve to see these missions through, that the sacrifices and costs and lives that we've invested in both of those countries? Are we going to see that through to stabilize those countries and eliminate the threat of the Taliban and al-Qaeda? That's what I want to know, and that's what's on my mind.
Big issue. All right, Dr. Ubel, you actually are a physician, so I don't know if there's anything you want to ask that's separate from healthcare, but what question would you ask?
Yeah, I have a non-healthcare question I would want to ask. I'd say, Mr. President, you campaigned against the Bush economy, saying 8 years of his presidency, six of which included Republican-controlled Congress, left Bush responsible for economic crisis. Now, with 6 months to work with a Democratic Congress to turn around our economy, unemployment continues to rise. Homeowners continue to default on their mortgages at staggering rates. How much is our current economy an Obama economy? What percent responsibility does your administration bear for our current troubles? And in fact, what amount of our general economy is directly related to presidential politics?
Well, again, another huge one. And Akeen McKenzie, visual display artist. Just quickly, what is a visual display artist?
We design storefront windows and showrooms. It's a lot of interior design, that type of thing.
I've seen a lot of empty storefront windows.
I know, there's a lot of that. Things pretty much dried up for me in January and February. They bounced back a little bit, but yeah, I got scared for a little while.
What would you ask?
So many questions. I guess my question would be spend or save. And I want to make clear that I'm not talking about governmental spending, because that's a whole nother can of worms, a whole nother question. but personal spending of the American people. Obviously, when we diagnose the problems of the economic downfall, we talk about people spending too much, getting loans that they couldn't pay back, car loans, home loans, all of that. Now, with the bailout, we talk about the banks. You know, why aren't you spending more? We gave you money, spend, but you've got a bunch of bad assets. Why would you spend? Don't you have to have something on the books? Don't you have to have some money? And then now when we talk about recovery, all we talk about is how much are people going to the malls? How much are people buying? And, of course, I want them to buy, too, because I need to do some visual display work. But I guess my question for the president would be, which is it, spend or save? Are you pressuring us to spend in order for us to go down the same path, to end up in the same place that we already were?
All right, Akeen, thanks for that. Akeen McKenzie is a visual display artist. Kristen Rouse is a lieutenant in the Army National Guard, veteran of the war in Afghanistan. And Peter Ubel is a physician in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We want to thank you all. And we want you to call us with the questions that you have.
Hi, this is Paul from New Jersey. I think the first question that needs to be asked is, why does my company pay more? Why do I pay more? Why does my doctor receive less every year?
All right, Lynn.
Coming up, we're going to continue talking about President Obama's primetime news conference. The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick joins us in 10 minutes for a behind-the-scenes look.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Lynn Scher.
And I'm Farai Chidea. Millions of people across Asia have been plunged into darkness by the longest total solar eclipse of this century. The shadow cast as the moon obscured the sun was observed in a corridor across India, China, and parts of Japan. Some places experienced the eclipse for more than 6.5 minutes. Scientists say it'll be more than 100 years later before there's another long eclipse like that. We're joined now by one of the lucky people who witnessed it, BBC reporter in the Indian capital, Delhi, and friend of The Takeaway, Jyotsna Singh. How are you?
I'm good. I was very lucky to be able to see a partial eclipse in where I was today. But a large number of people here in India were able to witness total eclipse for a little over 2 minutes in the Hindu holy city of Varanasi, because that was one place where it was seen, you know, the total eclipse was seen. A huge number of people, you know, about 60 to 70,000 people had gathered there since yesterday. They were camping there by the river Ganges because, you know, according to the Hindu religion, it has a lot of religious significance as well, and people do take a holy dip before and after the eclipse.
When you say religious significance, give me an example of, you know, what people believe this eclipse signifies.
Well, actually, this is something I discovered today. My parents live in Varanasi. That's where I come from. I grew up. But I discovered today that there is a belief that gods and goddesses become totally powerless during the eclipse. So there is no prayer that happens before and after. The idols are basically bathed in the holy Ganges River for them to gain power. The belief is that, you know, it's a monster that swallows the sun, and that's how the eclipse happens. But that's the religious side of it. The scientific phenomena, we all know, there were a large number of scientists who had gathered in a nearby town in Bihar, in Taregna, which is where it was supposed to be seen for the longest period.
Right.
And again, there were, you know, thousands of people who were who had come to the town to be able to see that. But they were very disappointed because it was very cloudy there, and so they couldn't see anything. It was only when it became really dark for a couple of minutes, you know, about 20 minutes past 6 o'clock local time, that people assumed that, you know, the solar eclipse had happened, and that's when they started chanting prayers, and, you know, the scientists were busy just trying to witness the whole phenomenon for their experiments.
Just very quickly, tell me your experience. Were you there in this sort of cloudy darkness, or were you someplace where you could perceive it a little bit more?
I was in Delhi on my rooftop with my little daughter, 8-year-old. It was a bit cloudy this morning, but we could make out that, you know, when it became sort of slightly darker, my daughter, who because you know, as I said, my parents come from Varanasi, which is where the total eclipse could be seen. We were constantly calling you know, my mother to check whether it had become absolutely dark. My daughter kept asking, so how does it look like? So can you actually make out?
Yeah, well, we have to end here, but I love it. Jyotsna Singh, BBC reporter in the Indian capital, Delhi. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Lynn Scher here with Farai Chidea. President Obama gives a primetime news conference tonight on health care and other issues. We get a behind-the-scenes look with our D.C. correspondent Todd Zwillick right after headlines with Femi Oki. Hi, Femi.
Hello. Good morning, everybody. Almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. President Obama has more than the big health care news conference on the agenda. He's also dealing with Iraq today. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki meets with the president in Washington this afternoon. Medical marijuana users in Oakland, California, now need to pay more to pick up their pot. Oakland is the first known city with a special tax on the drug. Medical marijuana is legal in California. Richard Lee sells it, and he is one of the many people who supported the introduction of the special marijuana tax.
There was no opposition ballot argument. There was just a big blank page on the blank spot on the page where the opposition argument would go.
So around 80% of Oakland residents passed the special tax in a vote yesterday. Now, there was always a regular sales tax on medical marijuana. This is an additional special tax. In international news, a new report shows that there is a sharp drop in Mexican immigration to the United States. The Pew Hispanic Center says that it's down almost 60% from last year. This is hitting the lowest level in a decade. Researchers believe that the drop is due to rising unemployment in America. And that is a look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi. Thanks, Femi. President Barack Obama makes a live televised speech tonight in large part to sell his health care plan to the country. For a quick update on what's going on behind the scenes, we are joined by our friend Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. What is Mr. Obama's main strategy right now? Why go to the American public with his health care plan?
Well, he really has to. This is sort of phase two in the strategy here. Phase one was to really let Congress do a lot of the heavy lifting and make the policy on this gigantic health care bill, by some counts, 1,000 pages, depending on which bill you're looking at. Certainly $1 trillion, so a big plan. Back in 93, the Clinton administration, tried to do it themselves. Congress didn't like that one bit, so they've done the opposite, given Congress the power. Now, the president needs to go in front of the public and push and explain to people very simply why we need to spend all this money, why it's an investment, and try to let them know that he's fighting for their interests. We all have health care. We all go to the doctor. We all pay for it one way or the other. So his job is to go in front of people and explain why this very, very heavy lift, this tough vote, these tough decisions have to be made, and frankly, try to get people to follow him. This is why we call them leaders. It's this moment.
What are the risks of his going to the public, do you think?
Well, he's stepping out in front. Really, it's that metaphorical going out on a limb. The president is going out every single day. He's been on television every day since Friday, making speeches, holding meetings. Tonight, the big news conference, as you mentioned. And he's going out in front of the public every day and saying, I want Congress to pass this. I need Congress to pass this. And if Congress doesn't pass it, if it fails, ultimately, that's on him. He tried. He went out on a limb. He said he wanted it. He tried to push Congress. He said it was necessary. He has to deliver.
And in fact, his ratings, we've seen his popularity ratings have already gone down to some extent. Perhaps that's health care. Is it the war? But this is a different approach from that of his predecessors. Let's listen first to how Bill Clinton dealt with one of his predecessors.
Employer-based private insurance for every American was proposed 20 years ago by President Richard Nixon to the United States Congress. It was a good idea then, and it's a better idea today.
Todd Zwillick, some people might be surprised that President Clinton referred to something President Nixon had done as a good thing. What is President Obama doing as he looks at the Clinton administration to change the way he goes about his health care, pushing his health care plan?
Well, it's really how you deal with Congress. Clinton's downfall and that cut you just heard was not one of them was pushing for an expansion of employer-based coverage, but the real downfall was one of strategy, writing a big, gigantic bill in the halls and the rooms of the White House and then plopping it down on Congress. And these senators who've been in power for 30 years didn't like that. Obama's done the opposite. You guys write the bill. Here are my broad principles. I want it to expand coverage. I want it to improve affordability and lower the cost curve. You write the bill. I'll work with you at the end. And that's trying to empower Congress. Now, Congress looks like it's done almost all it can do without presidential leadership. That's why he's stepping in now and trying to help get this done. Whether they get it done by August 7th or not, well, it's another story.
Indeed. And, I think that deadline is going to be a gone deadline very quickly.
Yep.
Todd Zwillick in Washington, stand by, if you will, for a further look at the differing approaches to health care reform that have been taken by U.S. presidents throughout the years. We are now joined by Paul Starr. He is a professor of sociology and public policy at Princeton University and the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine. Paul Starr was also a senior health policy advisor in the Clinton White House. Welcome, Mr. Starr. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you this morning.
Okay, so we heard that a bite before of President Clinton referring to Richard Nixon's approach to health care reform. Tell me, how has the executive branch used its power on health care reform? You can go back, I think, as far as FDR. Is that right?
Yes. The issue of health insurance was a state-level issue until the New Deal in the 1930s. And the committee that developed what ultimately became the Social Security system included in their proposal a plan for national health insurance in 1935. But FDR decided not to put that before Congress at that time because he thought it would be just too much at the time he wanted to establish old age insurance and unemployment insurance. And he hoped to come back to it, but he never did. The next one who did come back to it was his successor, Harry Truman, who did right after the Second World War. But that was not a good time to make that kind of proposal because of the Cold War, because Republicans controlled Congress in 1946. So
because once again the charge was made that health care would be socialism, right?
Oh, yeah, right, at that time. So reformers at that point backed off a general plan and instead decided, well, let's just have national health insurance for the elderly. And that became Medicare in 1965. That's certainly the single greatest success that health care reformers then had. But if there has to be a sort of one colossal mistake that reformers made, it goes back to the early 1970s. And you had that clip with Bill Clinton recalling Richard Nixon's proposal. Well, Richard Nixon in the early 1970s proposed two plans, and the second one in 1974 was really to the left of what President Obama is proposing today, because it really would have extended Medicare to everybody who didn't have employer-based insurance, would have required employers to provide insurance, and would have provided a federal plan for everybody else.
And this was under President
Nixon.
Right.
Red Nixon, yes. And Nixon at that point was struggling under the shadow of Watergate. And he probably, you know, was trying to move on it to regain his popularity. But Democrats would have nothing of it at that point, expecting to win the next elections, which they did in 74 and 76. But then the economy overtook everything.
Right.
That was, you know, stagflation, the oil embargo, and so forth.
And so that was the end of it until the Clinton administration, right?
Effectively, yes.
And what are the lessons from the Clinton administration's approach that the Obama administration has learned or could learn?
Well, you know, this is, in a way, it's amusing now.
It's the first time I've heard anybody find anything amusing in the healthcare debate.
Yeah, well, both sides are trying to reenact 1993 in different ways. Democrats are trying to do everything the reverse way from 1993, and Republicans are trying to do everything the same way because they succeeded then in torpedoing reform and then winning the 1994 election. So everything that happens now has in the background what happened before in 93. So, you know, yes, Obama has not worked out a plan himself, let Congress do it, but it's not as though presidents always fail when they present a detailed plan to Congress.
Thanks for that little trip through presidential history of healthcare. I'm sure we will be hearing from you more in the future. Paul Starr is a professor of sociology and public policy at Princeton, a senior health policy advisor in the Clinton White House, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine.
And you can get more on healthcare from Todd by going to our website. He's tweeting the debate, and we're asking you to be a reporter. What would you ask the president if given the chance at his big news conference tonight? Ed writes on our site, I would ask him his history with the pro-choice movement when he joined it. What was he taught, and what led him to be 100% pro-abortion? What would it take to change his views? Very provocative. Give us your question at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You know, Gina DePalma joined us earlier. She says you can have ice cream for breakfast. And Lynn, we did.
It was delicious.
She's the pastry chef of Babbo in New York. And sometimes you get to have so much fun here.
Changed my taste buds. I'm Lynn Scherr.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
has really got the power in the healthcare debate, Congress or the president? Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid has one opinion.
Barack Obama is the quarterback. He's been calling the plays. I think that's very important. Everyone understands that. And I think it's so important that the person who is calling the plays, it continues.
But some members of Congress and even governors are having their say and might have their way. It's all today on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, July 22nd. I am Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scher. We're filling in for John Hockenberry. Morning, Lynn.
Morning, Farai. So glad to be with you.
Likewise. And on our show today, we're going to visit Sesame Street for a look at the future of children's television in the internet age. Plus, we'll look at the sorry state of the airline industry and how it might wreck your summer travel. Right now, let's take a deeper look at healthcare. Michigan physician Dr. Peter Ubel is on the front lines. Dr. Ubel, what's the most important healthcare issue for the president? How do you think about it today?
I think the most important issue is to figure out how his plan is going to control healthcare costs and which special interest groups, doctors, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, which of these special interest groups will lose money because of that, because those are the people who will fight hard to oppose the plan.
Thanks so much, Dr. Ubel. We are going to have more of the conversation with you and a couple other folks about healthcare in a moment. First, everything you need to know this morning, Lynn.
Hi, Farai. In the headlines, President Obama has more than a big healthcare news conference on the agenda. He's also dealing with Iraq. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki meets with the president in Washington this afternoon. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has strong words on Iran's nuclear ambitions. She warns if Iran gets the bomb, the U.S. will ramp up defense capacity of American allies in the Mideast. Clinton is in Thailand today. She's meeting with Asian leaders at a regional summit. She's also giving a new warning to North Korea about its nuclear moves.
And elsewhere in Asia, U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke is in Pakistan, meeting with top leaders. He's also visiting Afghanistan. Our partner at the New York Times reports that Pakistani officials tell the Obama administration they're worried the new American push in Afghanistan is going to drive more militants into Pakistan across the border. And a pricey fighter jet program is dead, shot down by a bipartisan coalition. Both President Obama and Senator John McCain supported the Senate vote to kill further production of the F-22. They say it's not suited for current unconventional wars.
A new report shows a sharp drop in Mexican immigration to the U.S. The Pew Hispanic Center says it's down 60% from last year, the lowest level in a decade. Researchers believe the drop is due to rising unemployment in America.
And looking at the markets, Wall Street moved up a bit yesterday. The Dow starts trading at 89.15, the S&P at 954, NASDAQ at 1916. President Obama is holding a primetime news conference tonight to sell his health care plan, but the question is on the table. What would you ask the president if given a chance? Adam wrote us and said, I would ask him why he's going back on his promises of restoring civil liberties and transparency in government by supporting Bush's executive orders. Have your say. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scher. We are both sitting in for John Hockenberry. President Obama is pushing hard for a deadline he probably won't make, selling his health care bill to the nation. He makes a televised primetime speech tonight, but his hopes of having Congress put a bill on the floor by summer recess dwindle with every day. After all, congressional recess is only a few short weeks away. There's little consensus on how to make health care reform happen. Senator Tom Coburn thinks the president's expectations could be unrealistic.
I want us to succeed in health care reform. But I wanted healthcare is absolutely personal and it affects every person in this country. And for us to have the audacity to think in 2.5 months we can fix all those problems is just plain stupid.
All right, our own Todd Zwillick is with us from Washington to give the latest on this news conference and, you know, everything else on health care. Let's talk first about the action on the Hill yesterday and coming up. Where are we in this process in the House of Representatives?
All right. Well, meetings. Good morning, Farai. The Energy and Commerce Committee is the only committee that hasn't marked up their legislation, and it's a major pivot point in this right now. There was a markup scheduled to start yesterday, where markup is where all the members of the committee come together and give amendments to the bill and chop it all up. That was postponed yesterday and moved to today for more discussions, more meetings with those conservative Blue Dog Democrats. Well, postponed again today. They're not going to be marking up today because discussions continue. However, there is it's not to say there's no progress to speak of. Those Blue Dogs have been meeting with the president, with leadership, and there's a little bit of consensus growing around this idea of having an independent government agency that goes around and sort of polices Medicare and the healthcare program and passes basically passes policies to control costs. This would be made up of outside experts who would be able to set prices for Medicare in a way that drops the cost. Now, right now, I should add very quickly, Medicare prices are set by Congress, and a lot of people think that this is a system that is just rife with special interest, with parochial interest. All it does is drive up healthcare costs. There's liberal Democrats on the Senate side, like Jay Rockefeller. There's conservative Democrats on the House side, like these Blue Dogs we talked about, and they all seem to want to do this, and there's some consensus coalescing around this. Listen to Jay Rockefeller talking about his amendment to have basically a policeman agency for Medicare to drive down cost.
Congresspeople should not be using Medicare reimbursement for their benefit. And you're right, that's exactly what they do. And that's exactly what the lobbyists want to see. And that's exactly why I want both of them eliminated from the entire process.
So Farai, that was the glimmer of progress yesterday. Liberal Democrats like Rockefeller, conservative Democrats all agreeing that they want to see this in the bill.
All right. Just quickly, you'll be there tonight. If you get a chance to ask a question of the president, what will it be?
Well, I have a lot of questions, some about Afghanistan, but as long as we're talking about healthcare, you know, the president has said he has some principles on this. He wants it to control costs. It has to be deficit neutral. It has to expand coverage. But I want to know what the president's metric for success is in terms of covering the uninsured. If Congress passes something that only covers 50% of the uninsured, will that be success, or does he want 90%? I think the president should tell people what exactly success is here. Are we going to spend a lot of money and only get 9 million or 10 million more people insured?
Mm-hmm. Well, Todd, stay with us. Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's own Todd Zwillick, always on the Hill, always on patrol. We've also got some friends in the studio this morning coming back in with us. They talked to us a little bit more earlier about what they would ask the president if given the chance tonight. Non-healthcare questions. Now we move on to healthcare. We have Kristen Rouse, First Lieutenant in the Army National Guard, veteran of the war in Afghanistan. Akeen McKenzie, visual display artist. They're both here in the studio with me. And Dr. Peter Ubel, physician and behavioral scientist in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So the question is, healthcare, what would you ask? Akeen.
Preventative health care. I know that's one of his big pushes, and that's the only way we can afford it is if we start fixing these issues before they become big issues. How do you do that? Are we going to have a concentration on nutrition, on exercise? Are we going to have, you know, regular business visits to these doctors? Are we going to be able to have screenings? Lord knows, I could probably use a little more. I fortunately grew up with a mother who had a great education on nutrition and instilled that in me. Although I don't necessarily abide by that now. I wish I did more, but we need more of that. And can we do that? I guess this is the big thrust of my question, is can we do that in a system that does not reward health in the patients? There's no financial reward for healthy patients. Would it make sense to have a system where doctors financially, or the system financially benefits from healthy patients rather than by sick ones?
All right. Dr. Ubel, just coming off of what Akeen said, it's really about preventative medicine rewarding consumers, essentially, human beings, for being healthy. I'm not sure, before we get to your specific question, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think I am a primary care physician. I very much believe in prevention, but it doesn't save money, usually. And so we have to decide, you know, while we give emphasis to prevention, what does that mean for how we control healthcare costs?
Okay, what would you ask the president?
I'd like a concrete example of how he would go about controlling healthcare costs, and a concrete enough that Americans could feel comfortable with how his plan would work and what it would mean for their relationship with their doctor.
You know, I want to go back to Todd. I want to ask you, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's own Todd Zwillick, that question of preventative care. I've heard some politicians in this debate saying, well, you know, that actually does cost money. How does that play out?
Well, nobody really knows what to do with prevention on the Hill. It's very interesting. We've heard about the CBO lots of times, the Congressional Budget Office, and it's a bit wonky, but they're really important in the debate right now because they're the arbiters of whether something can officially be deemed a money saver or a money spender. And they don't know how to deal with prevention. There is a debate in the academic community and in the economics community about which prevention saves money and how, and CBO doesn't know what to do with all this stuff. So when they tell the congressman, you know, we might think intuitively that controlling obesity is going to mean less spending in the long term. People are thinner. They don't get as much diabetes, as much heart disease. It really makes sense to the average mind that that would save money. Well, CBO can't show that, and CBO can't give you credit on your bill, your legislative bill, to say, yes, you will save X billion number of dollars. So that's really frustrating for members of Congress who want to do the right thing in terms of health care and can't get any credit on the dollar end. So they wind up saying, well, it's just the right thing to do. It may be an investment. They don't know how to handle that.
Right. Well, let's turn to Kristen Rouse. You are in the Army National Guard. You've served overseas in some very tough conditions. What would you ask the president?
Well, healthcare is such an important issue to all Americans. I know that. But of personal concern to me is, what is the administration doing right now to ensure that returning veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan are receiving the physical and mental health resources that they need? Because the need is now. There's a lot of VA facilities and a lot of Department of Defense facilities. They do provide excellent health care, and I've been fortunate to receive excellent health care from, you know, when I was on active duty at Fort Drum. But the reality is that what's in place right now is not enough.
There was something called informally the Dole Shalala report that was supposed to reform VA health care. Do you think anything's changed in the past year?
I believe that changes have been made, and of course there's been a lot more public attention, and that's good. But there remains a huge VA backlog of claims, and a lot of returning veterans are having to either use their private health insurance or pay out of pocket for service-connected problems, whether that be mental health issues or physical issues.
All right. I want to do kind of a speed round here because we don't have very much time, but I'm going to ask all three of you, would you be willing to pay more taxes to accomplish the missions that you just set out? Kristen.
I am a proud taxpayer because I benefit from taxes. American taxpayers pay my salary when I am on military duty. And so and I'm honored to be paid for by taxpayers. And so, yes, if, you know, better quality of life, better services come at a higher price. And if it's efficient, then I'm willing to pay for that.
Akeen?
If the benefits are tangible, absolutely.
All right. Dr. Ubel.
I would, because I think if you can control health care costs, I'll pay more in taxes but less in health insurance premiums, and I'll come out ahead.
All right, Todd, I'm not going to ask you to, you know, sum up the higher taxes for yourself, but very briefly, do you think that in general the American people are willing to pay more?
The American people have said that they're willing to pay more in some polls. The polls are a little bit confusing on
right.
this. They say they're willing to pay more, but it depends on the policy. People's costs are already very, very high. The president needs to convince people that
thanks.
Paying a little bit more in taxes will cut their spending, just like the doctor said.
All right. Well, thanks to Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, Dr. Peter Ubel, physician at the University of Michigan, Kristen Rouse, Army National Guard, and Akeen McKenzie, visual display artist. You have brought a lot of clarity to a very, very tough issue. Thanks.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, everybody. My name is Ray, and I'm going to sing the alphabet today one time through from A to Z, and then I want all you kids to sing along with me. But first, A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
Oh, sing along with Ray Charles on Sesame Street. Is that fabulous or what? Well, he's there for a lot of reasons, and part of it is that 20 years ago, it seemed very radical when the House Commerce Committee passed the Children's Television Act, and that was a measure to promote educational programming and to limit the amount of marketing targeted at kids. Today, that same committee will be hearing testimony to update that law. In today's multimedia landscape of on-demand programming, streaming web content, online gaming, and iPhones, a law that focuses exclusively on plain old broadcast television, like the TV that's carried Ray Charles, the kids, to your kids. Anyway, that kind of law is gathering dust and doing little to regulate what our kids actually see and hear. So what will a brave new world of children's programming look like? We turn now to Gary Nell, the president and CEO of Sesame Workshop. That's the parent company which produces Sesame Street. He's on his way to testify to the Commerce Committee about how he thinks Congress should step in the digital age. Also, we're joined by Dade Hayes, a father and author of Anytime Playdate, a book that looks inside the preschool entertainment boom. Welcome to both of you. Dade, let me start with you. You're the dad of a 2-year-old son, a 5-year-old daughter. Do you think that Congress should be legislating what's on your kids' TV?
Well, I do think it's important when that they take some sort of action to just show that they're awake. I mean, one thing that was interesting in my research is that, I was a little disturbed to see how little activity there was, you know, on a government level. I mean, thankfully, I was encouraged to connect with folks like Gary and many, many other very responsible producers and executives out there who are doing a really outstanding job. But, you know, I do think it's important that the government take an interest, just as they do with education in general and other societal issues. So I think it's a step in the right direction.
Okay, Gary Nell, how will Sesame and Sesame Street change if the law changes? What do you think is in it?
Well, we're certainly not going to change Elmo. We would never want to do that, Lynn. But I think.
Oh, thank goodness! And by the way, I've got an entire list that you shouldn't change.
Okay. Well, please send it to me after the show. You know, this isn't really about how Sesame Street's going to change. This is really about, as Dade said, shining a spotlight on the issues around children's education and children's health, because media plays just an enormous role in impacting children and adults, but especially children in our country. And I think Congress needs to shine a spotlight on those issues, and that's what the hearing's about today.
And is there any concern that by letting Congress do this, that this is just the beginning of regulating the Internet? I remember what all the arguments were back in 1990 and pre-1990 when the Children's Television Act was first proposed. Everybody was scared to death. Of course, it brought us many, many wonderful things. What about the process this time?
Well, I think there's a lot of things, you know, where Chicken Little cries that the sky will fall. I mean, there's a bunch of issues that are floating around. We need to have more educational programming for 6 to 11-year-olds in this country. There's a real dearth of that. And I think one of the things that's changed, Lynn, since the 1990 Act is you've got really three dominant channels, Nickelodeon, Disney, and Cartoon Network, which dominate close to 90% of the viewing audience. So, and those guys control content and distribution. So they're very powerful voices. So this whole idea of getting all these commercial broadcasters to do educational program was a great idea, but it's almost totally irrelevant today. So there are issues which need to be brought to the forefront, and I think we need to update the Congress, and the Congress needs to think about, and the FCC needs to think about what actions are appropriate.
Dade Hayes, what do you teach your children about television? How much time can they watch? And what about the internet? Do you regulate it yourself? And should parents be doing this?
Well, those are great questions. I mean, I try to aim for an hour a day. That's sort of the outer limit. I don't always succeed. I think most parents, have to admit that, they have their off days. And in terms of, the internet, what I find really powerful is that it's an enhancement to the notion of media literacy. It's an idea that you can really control your media experience to a much greater degree than you can with television. And, I don't want to be too sort of Pollyanna about it, but I think that's actually a very exciting and empowering notion that, while we do have to be concerned about the, creeping forces of advertising, I also think the internet allows us to have a more self-selected media experience. And I think that's a very powerful notion for children to adopt early on.
And in fairness, the act didn't completely get rid of all advertising and marketing. I mean, Gary Nell, Tickle Me Elmo, it's not exactly, it's a moneymaker.
Sure, and that helps pay for the research and production of Sesame Street. And look, we live in a country and a society where we have lots of free programming that advertisers have made possible. We don't want to end that. That's an important thing. But I do think there are limits around things like, food advertising, the influence that that's had on children's health, as we have a huge obesity crisis in this country, where kids growing up today may have a shorter lifespan than their parents. And the influence of food marketing on those kids, the Institute of Medicine has said, has had a deleterious effect. So there are areas in which I think we need to sort of shine a light 20 years later that have changed. And I totally agree with Dade that the internet and other media have a great educational ability to have an interactive experience that will drive home educational material. But let's figure out a way to do that.
Indeed, let's figure it out. And the committee, at least, will get started today. Thanks to both of you, Gary Nell from Sesame Workshop, Dade Hayes, a dad, and an author of The Anytime Playdate, Inside the Preschool Entertainment Boom, or How Television Became My Baby's Best Friend. Now let's hear some more music. And then we go to Femi Okeh with the headlines.
My news is music to your ears this morning, I do hope so. 28 minutes past the hour. Good morning, everybody. Healthcare continues to be at the top of the president's agenda. It's expected to be the focus of his primetime press conference tonight. But first this afternoon, he will meet with Iraqi President Nouri al-Maliki. They're expected to talk about the progress of political, religious and ethnic reconciliation in Iraq. Now, the world's first human test of a vaccine for H1N1 or swine flu is now underway in Australia. Vaccine expert Andrew Cuthbertson is running the vaccine tests.
We have a specific vaccine that we believe will be able to protect millions of people against this new H1N1 flu.
The vaccine should be ready by October. That's a look at some of the top stories from this morning's news.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scher. We're sitting in for John Hockenberry. Airlines are releasing their quarterly earnings reports this week. Southwest and United eked out a small profit yesterday, while Continental announced a slight loss, but at least the ads are still perky.
On other airlines, meals have become pie in the sky. On Continental, we're still proud to serve complimentary meals at mealtime.
Attention passengers, on your left there's a delicious chicken pot pie.
Continental Airlines. Work hard, fly right.
So, yeah, you got the free meal on one hand, but then on the other hand, a new $20 fee to check your bags. Charisse Jones is with us in studio. She covers airlines for USA Today. Charisse, let's start with Continental. Second quarter loss of $213 million, announcing that it's raising those fees to check luggage and laying off 1,700 more workers. What's going on?
You know, Continental is really going through a lot of the same tribulations that the rest of the airline industry is experiencing. I mean, people are just not flying for business or for pleasure. The high-spending, high-flying business travelers who normally pay the big money for the first-class seats are parking in coach instead or booking weeks ahead of time to get the low fares. So as a result, Continental's had to cut 1,700 more jobs on top of 1,200 that were already announced. And the nickeling and diming continues, the $20 now for the first bag, $30 for the second. And if you want somebody on the other line when you call to make a reservation, it's going to cost you $5 more. So it's happening throughout the industry, and they really just exemplify the crisis that they're in.
Fuel costs have been blamed, but also Continental said that H1N1, the virus that is known as swine flu, cost the airline $50 million. How do you parse that out, and do you think it affected other airlines?
Absolutely. I mean, the airline industry was really hit by a double whammy. You know, the recession happened, the economy tanked, people stopped flying. And then in May, we had this scare with the swine flu. And so a lot of airlines that fly to either Mexico or even China found that people were staying put. They didn't want to go to those parts of the world. And the reason why Asia came into the equation is people remembered the bird flu, which happened a few years back. So people were just very skittish about flying, and it really put a big dent in revenue for most airlines.
All right. Boeing, which is a plane manufacturer, announces its quarterly numbers this morning. But the U.S. Army announced it's canceling a contract worth billions. They were trying to develop a manned ground vehicle for combat. What can we expect to hear from Boeing?
Boeing is probably going to be okay today coming out of the second quarter because they get paid when they deliver planes, and they had a lot of pending deliveries. The problem is the next year or two when their deliveries have gotten a lot lower. You know, they've got the Army problem. They have the so-called Dreamliner, which was this great 787 they were putting out, which has been delayed several times. So they're probably going to be fine today, but going into the future, we may have a problem.
All right. Just kind of a yes or no answer. Could one of the major airlines fold within the next year?
It's possible, yes.
All right. Charisse, you have given us a ton of information. Charisse Jones covering airlines for USA Today with us in studio. Lynn?
Thanks, Farai. We're going to move now from the state of the airline industry to the state of the economy as a whole. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke began his 2 days of testimony before Congress yesterday.
The U.S. economy contracted sharply in the fourth quarter of last year and the first quarter of this year. More recently, the pace of decline appears to have slowed significantly, and final demand and production have shown tentative signs of stabilization. The labor market, however, has continued to weaken.
Good news, bad news. So where, in fact, does the economy stand today? To help us answer that is Managing Director of the Economic Cycle Research Institute, a company that forecasts recessions and recoveries. Oh, really? Can you do that? Lakshman Ajuthan. First of all, can you do that? If you could do that, how come we didn't know this was going to happen?
Not everybody listens. There's a lot of noise out there, but we've had a pretty good run.
Okay. Break it down for us, Lakshman, if you will. Chairman Bernanke said in lay terms. What was he saying, really?
There was a lot going on. There's a lot in between the lines. The first thing is it's nice that we're at the point where we can talk about an exit strategy. Just a couple of quarters ago, we were staring into the abyss. So that's a positive. But what's going on here is he's giving a slight signal to one side of the market or the aisle that we're not going to let inflation get out of control, while at the same time he's saying, I'm not in a hurry to raise interest rates and choke off this recovery that is taking shape this summer. And that's a very tight line to walk. And then there's also his reappointment, which is coming up later at the beginning of the year.
And what about the fact, he mentioned this part about the labor market continuing to weaken. Right. If, in fact, the labor market continues to weaken, right, how in the world does the economy recover?
Okay, a few things going on here. It will continue to weaken because the jobs market is a coincident indicator. This unemployment rate that we are all focused on is actually a lagging indicator. It will rise always into the early stages of a recovery. And if you recall, I think policymakers were suggesting just a while back that unemployment wouldn't go this high. Mm-hmm. So they're being real careful and probably setting the bar so low, saying, hey, it could go to 10 or 11%, so that hopefully they beat it this time.
The American public doesn't seem to agree with what Mr. Bernanke is saying. He expressed some optimism yesterday.
Right.
And yet the latest ABC News Washington Post poll about consumer confidence says confidence in President Obama's recovery plan is down to 56%. It was 72% in January. What does that tell us?
Well, I think there's time as this has drawn on. Now, this is Obama's economy. Right. Earlier on, it maybe wasn't necessarily his economy. So he's starting to really own it here. And it's kind of like, show me the money. Show me the where's the beef? You have to turn this thing around. And unless this recession draws to a close soon, I expect those numbers will keep going down. However, the forward looking indicators are telling us, I think things should improve.
Go out on a limb.
Yes.
Give us a forecast. What is your crystal ball saying right now?
Well, we've been out on a limb since April that the recession ends this summer. I'm sticking with that. Our indicators are soaring.
And that is good news indeed. All right. Lakshman Achuthan, thank you very much. Managing Director of Economic Cycle Research Institute, which forecasts recessions and recoveries. Fingers crossed that you're right. And by the way, we are listening this time. Thanks so much. Femi, headlines?
Thank you very much. At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke is in Pakistan today. He'll meet with political leaders and top generals, as well as civilians from Pakistan's volatile northwest. He will also travel to Afghanistan later this week. Now, this comes as our partner, the New York Times, reports that Pakistan is objecting to the U.S. expansion of military operations in Afghanistan. They believe an influx of American troops is causing militants to flee across the border into Pakistan. The lone surviving gunman in the November terror attacks in Mumbai says that he's ready to die as punishment. The Pakistani citizen confessed yesterday to the attacks that killed more than 160. And back in the U.S., a candlelight vigil is being planned in Idaho tonight for the safe return of a U.S. soldier who's been captured by the Taliban in Afghanistan. The Taliban released a video showing the soldier last week. Let's look at some top stories from today's headlines.
Thanks so much, Femi. And coming up, we're going to talk about race and racial profiling. Provocative. 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm Lynn Scher. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had some tougher talk to Iran today. Speaking from Thailand, she said Washington is prepared to upgrade the defense of its allies in the Gulf if Iran continues to develop its nuclear program.
If the United States extends a defense umbrella over the region, if we do even more to support the military capacity of those in the Gulf, it's unlikely that Iran will be any stronger or safer.
Well, what is she referring to? To assess what this means, we spoke with John Line, BBC correspondent in London, earlier this morning. I asked him why this statement is so important.
Well, I think Hillary Clinton's addressing various audiences, really. Obviously, she's speaking directly to Iran, trying to get them to the table, trying to get them into serious negotiations about their nuclear program. But I think, realistically, the administration knows they're not going to get much change out of the Iranian government, particularly at the moment when they're all tangled up in their dispute over the presidential elections. So it's also a signal to other countries in the region. The administration, my understanding is the administration, the West in general, is concerned about Iran, of course, but also maybe about the reactions to a possible Iranian nuclear program. Now, we know, of course, about the many threats there have been from Israel, for example, for a unilateral military strike. but also worries that particularly Arab countries might push their nuclear programs forward, particularly, for example, Saudi Arabia, which could perhaps even go to Pakistan and say, could you give us some help in trying to produce our own nuclear weapons if we fear that Iran is or is about to have a nuclear bomb.
So there's a whole, no pun intended, there's a whole chain reaction then if this sort of thing would happen.
Absolutely. And equally, this diplomacy, well, just like what's going on in Iran, really, the diplomacy is multi-layered, because the other thing, as Mrs. Clinton has almost admitted openly, is that by going to Iran and by opening the door for negotiations, they can then turn around in a few months' time and say to Russia and China, look, we've tried our very, very best. You said we should have dialogue, we should have talks. We've done that. We've opened the door to Iran. We've had no change from them. Now it's your turn to step up. You know, you've got to vote for new sanctions, which are going to be coming on the agenda in the next few months.
John Lyne with the BBC speaking to us from London. Just briefly, if you can, what do you think a defense umbrella, which Secretary Clinton has described today, what do you think that might look like?
I'm not sure there's any very concrete ideas. I think it's more a words of reassurance that the United States will stand behind these countries and that Iran won't make any benefits by getting a nuclear weapon.
Can you briefly, John Lyne, tell us about the situation in Iran right now? Things seem to be calmer. What's the outlook there?
There's still continued demonstrations on the streets. There were demonstrations yesterday. We're not quite sure of the scale of them. And at the same time, there's great disputes within the elite, within the government itself. So I think in no way has President Ahmadinejad consolidated his position.
That's the BBC's John Lyne speaking earlier this morning about a toughening stance toward Iran from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
We will still hold the door open, but we also have made it clear that we'll take actions, as I've said, you know, time and time again, crippling actions, working to upgrade the defense of our partners in the region.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea here with Lynn Scher. We're in for John Hockenberry. Coming up next, we talk about the arrest of one of the nation's top African-American scholars, that is Henry Louis Gates Jr. of Harvard, at his home. What does that case say about race and racial profiling? That's the conversation right after headlines with Femi Oke.
Coming to you at 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, it's going to be hard to miss President Obama on TV tonight. Networks and cable news channels will show his primetime press conference on healthcare. Now, this is part of a heavy White House push to keep healthcare legislation moving as Congress prepares to take an August recess. A pricey fighter jet program is dead. The Senate is cutting funding for the further production of the F-22 jet. Senator John McCain says the defense budget is not the employment office.
This is not the way to provide jobs. Our obligation is to defend this nation.
President Obama also wanted the funding cut. Critics say that the high-tech planes aren't suited to today's unconventional wars. But supporters say that besides creating jobs, the F-22 would be needed in future wars conducted in large countries. Former Vice President Dick Cheney will continue to have Secret Service protection. The law provides VPs 6 months of security after leaving office. Cheney requested an extension, which the Obama administration granted. Asia has been sky-gazing today. Parts of the continent had a prime view of the longest total solar eclipse of the century. And you can hear the excitement as the crowds gather. So the crowds gathered to watch the moon cover the sun, and this tourist in India was moved by the turn from day to night.
Well, it's very powerful to have a night
in the middle of the day. One thing interesting was when you looked up, there was a star, a bright star in the sky. So it was as dark as night. You could see the stars in the sky.
You can hear the excitement in his voice. The eclipse was visible across several Asian countries, from India into parts of China. And if you're hoping to see a total solar eclipse visible from the US, 2017, put that in your diary. Continuing with the news, medical marijuana users must now pay a new tax on drugs bought in Oakland, California. Now, it's believed to be the first city with such a tax. Around 80% of Oakland residents passed it in yesterday's vote. Medical marijuana has been legal in California since 1996. And that is a look at some of the big stories making news headlines this morning.
Thanks so much, Femi. And also making headlines, well, race relations. Once again, there's this term post-racial. It's a phrase that some people use to characterize the Obama era, a time when we're supposed to move beyond prejudices that divide our community. Yeah, right. That's what some people have said since the election of the first black president. And now more people are questioning the post-racial paradigm after one of the top African-American scholars was arrested at his own home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. His name is Henry Louis Gates Jr. His friends call him Skip. In addition to teaching at Harvard, he also runs the prominent online publication, TheRoot.com. While the charges against Gates have been dropped, questions about race are front and center. With us now, Paul Butler, former federal prosecutor, law professor at George Washington University, author of Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. We've also got David Wall Rice, a psychology professor at Morehouse College. Now, Paul, let's start with you and go over the background. Gates says that last Thursday he was locked out of his house. He and his driver pushed against the door of his home until it opened. Then the police arrived. Gates says he showed his ID as a homeowner and as a Harvard professor. Then, as is documented in a news photograph, he was handcuffed and led from his home on charges that he was disorderly. This is what a spokesperson from the Cambridge police had to say yesterday.
Our position is very firmly that race did not play any factor at all in the arrest of Professor Gates.
Okay, Paul, do you think that race was part of the issue?
Of course. Again, we've thought about driving while black and walking while black. This is just being at your home while black. But there's no way, Farai, that if it had been a white Harvard law professor, especially someone of Mr. Gates' distinction, and even his carriage. The man is in his 50s. He uses a cane. There's no way he would have been treated like this if you were a white man.
All right, David Wall Rice, you're a professor at Morehouse, historically black men's college. You actually have written on our blog at thetakeaway.org that you don't find Professor Gates' arrest to be surprising. Why not?
No, not at all. I think the surprise for me is really the surprise of it all. I mean, he's a black man in America, and I think that, you know, this post-racial society and this, Touré wrote on the Daily Beast this morning, this kind of kumbaya attitude really is, it doesn't exist. And so I think that this is bringing a lot of kind of attention to, you know, things that have persisted for black males in particular for since forever.
All right. Well, you know, like everywhere else, our listeners are paying attention to this. Here's one perspective from Naqib.
The police officer said that he was being charged with disorderly conduct because of his loud and tumultuous behavior in a public space. I really thought, come on, I mean, a man's home is now deemed a public space? That doesn't sound right. Only, I suppose, if you're a man of a certain complexion, I think, does your Fourth Amendment right to be secure in your property mean that little.
All right, David, what about, not just being in your home while black, but being in your home while brown? Does anyone else really experience this the way that black men do?
I don't think so. I mean, I really don't. I think that, you know, I think there's a special type of threat to the patriarchy that black males kind of present. I mean, and I think that, you know, the juxtaposition of the black male image against the white male image since the time of slavery, you know, emasculating black males and, you know, the physical abuse that's visited on black males is something that unfortunately has made its way into the enforcement industry, as it were. And so I think black males are particularly salient examples, and kind of hallmarks for how black people are treated in the United States. But I think that the treatment of black males is very unique. Dave Chappelle might say it's a special kind of racism that's visited on us.
All right, Paul Butler, again, you're a former federal prosecutor. You wrote this book, Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. We talked to you about it. It's controversial. You yourself have had an unpleasant cross incident with the law. Can you just tell us quickly about it?
Well, which one, Farah?
The one you lead your book
with. I know
with.
The one you're referring to. You know, it was basically got arrested for a crime that I didn't commit. It was a silly little misdemeanor, a Fred and Barney dispute about a parking space. But my real crime, like Skip's, was being an uppity black man in front of a cop. You know, the police jokingly refer to that as contempt of cop. And what you get charged with officially is disorderly conduct. But David is right. The police engage in these kind of who's the man masculinity contests. And you know, there are things you can do if you don't want to get locked up. You can not look them in the eye. You can be deferential. But sometimes when you're a black man who's tried to do the right thing all your life and you end up still getting treated like a you know what, you do get loud and tumultuous.
Before we wrap up, again, just very quickly, I want to ask both of you. Princeton professor Melissa Harris-Lacewell, who's been on our air as well, said this is what we should take from the incident. I watched the police handcuff American possibility. Is it really that deep? David Walrice.
I do think it's that deep, but I don't think that it's something that can't be fixed or negotiated. But I think the thing that becomes important is for us really speak truth to power and to recognize what's going on. You know, the idea that Skip Gates was arrested is really not a big deal in the scheme of things. He said in his statement that, you know, he was one of over a million black males who was arrested or jailed last week. And he's one of a million. So it's great that we're paying attention to it. But we really have to do something about it. We have to be pragmatic and practical about it and how we address and appreciate what's going on with black males and black people in the United States.
Okay, Paul, just a quick bit.
Yeah, you know, I agree. Skip Gates and I, with our excellent lawyers and our middle-class privilege, we're going to be just fine. But the larger concern is our young brothers, statistically, who can expect they're going to have the same kind of experience that we had, and they don't have our same access to resources. So God help them.
Well, we're definitely going to be watching this story. We have been speaking with Paul Butler, law professor at George Washington University, author of Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. Also, David Walrice, associate professor of psychology at Morehouse College. And we have more of David Walrice writing about Professor Gates' arrest and the illusion of a post-racial America, what some would say, on thetakeaway.org. You can also weigh in. Like Matthew did, he writes on our site, Matthew says, while there's no doubt that racial profiling played a role in the arrest, Professor Gates' behavior after the fact shows that he is out of touch with the experiences of most blacks in this country. Unfortunately, relatively benign events of mistaken identity happen all the time, and most black people are familiar enough with it to stay calm and joke about it with their friends afterward.
Joke or cry, one of the two. Mm-hmm. Another issue we are following all day is President Obama's news conference later tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern to sell his health care plan, among other things. You can follow our own Todd Zwillick on Twitter as he covers the health care issue. Sign up for his feed at thetakeaway.org.
Well, this has been quite an exciting show. Waiting for the Obama show. I'm Farai Chidea.
I'm Lynn Scherr.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.